This podcast is free and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
From KUOW in Seattle, welcome to Soundside. I'm Libby Dankman. This week marks the 10th anniversary of the Oso landslide. On March 22, 2014, a wall of mud and debris rushing 60 miles an hour hit the neighborhood of Steelhead Haven near the North Fork of the Stillaguamish River along Highway 530. 43 people were killed. It remains the deadliest landslide in U.S. history. Later this hour, we're going to dive into why landslides like Oso happen and what's being done to mitigate their harm. But first, I want to revisit a conversation I had a few years ago in Oso around the 8th anniversary of the tragedy. Seth Jeffords lost his granddaughter, Sanoa, and his wife, Chris, in the 2014 slide. They lived in a house on Steelhead Drive. It was part of a decades-old riverfront development that lacked proper permits and shouldn't ever have been built. But Jeffords wasn't made aware of this when his family moved in, and he believes the tragic loss of life in his neighborhood could have been prevented if logging companies and government officials had done more to warn residents about the known risks of landslides there. A permanent memorial to the victims who died is being dedicated on Friday. When I ran into Seth in 2022, he was clearing brush from the temporary site.
Can you tell me a little bit about your family and who you lost here?
Well, I lost my wife, and my granddaughter, and my dog. And, of course, my neighbors and friends and the kids. And yeah.
This is your home.
This we all lived here 18 years.
How often do you come to the site?
I'm here. I don't want it. But I come up and mow. And when it needs mowing, I mow, you know. So it's usually about once a week or so in the summertime. And then in the wintertime, we come up, like, you know, just occasionally, you know, not as often. So, but, yeah, I plant daffodils. And we plant daffodils down there. We're coming down the highway there. You saw the daffodils.
I saw those, yeah.
Yeah, that's where my wife and my granddaughter were found.
What was that decision like to stay?
Well, initially, right off the bat, I told my older brother, I'm moving to Idaho. I'm getting the hell out of here. He goes, like, settle down. You know, you just, no rash decisions here. Just settle down. And then again, I felt compelled to stay here because people were so stinking nice, you know, it's super supportive, and it's, I felt not an obligation, but I felt somewhat of an obligation. It's like people are so, you know what I mean, they're looking out for us. So a lot of people moved away, and so
a lot of families.
Yeah. And that's just how it is. You want to take a walk? Let's walk down here.
Yeah.
I'll show you where you used to live.
Let's take a walk.
I was told by somebody that said, well, you wouldn't have moved anyways. Well, I should have had that right to make that decision ourselves, you know.
Somebody said that to you?
Yep. So like Harry Truman with Mount St. Helens, granted, he took the gamble. He lived there his whole life or whatever, and that's the choice he made. And there might have been one or two people here, you know, that had done that. Who knows? But I can tell you, my wife would have been like, we're out of here, you know. According to GPS, this is right where it sat. So, So still got a good view of the hill. And, yeah.
And you lived in this house for 18 years?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
We were married for 6, but we're together for 21 years.
Wow.
People used to say, why don't you marry her? Jokingly, well, you don't want to rush into something, you know. Regrets. I should have married her years and years before. So,
the love was there.
Yeah, still is. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Still is.
Yeah. It's such a beautiful place.
It's odd, but it's pretty in its own regards. But it's odd.
Yeah.
You know, all the hummocks and stuff. It's like, this one over here, I think they said it's 70 feet higher than originally. The dirt mounds, the hummocks.
Yeah.
They didn't do any digging over here. All the digging was on the other side of the highway over there and where the highway itself is.
You just, your brain can't really process how
that much material can go that far.
Yeah.
It's because the hill is full of water.
Yeah.
But our neighbors, Ty and Amanda, they would have lived, see that dead tree is there? Just a little bit of that, so across the yard. And she was home, right? And she heard it, and then she looked out her window and saw our house coming right at her, you know.
But she survived?
She survived, and her little son, Duke, survived. I used to go rafting, like, a lot, you know. And so Chris is always great with it. I was like, honey, you got fun. Tell me all about it when you get home. And so this particular weekend, it's the only time she'd ever said it. It's like, honey, this weekend, you're staying home, you know. Like, okay. So there's a run that some people were doing, and I had never done it. And so I begged her to let me go. And she's like, no. You said, and I begged her. And she says, okay, but when you get home, you belong to me. Yeah, you bet, hon. Yeah. That was that. I was up at Grant Falls, and I used to be on the fire department. My pager goes off. And so the run they were doing was not really a raft run. It was more of a kayak run, and they didn't know that. So I was coming back. I tried calling Chris, and she didn't answer, you know. So I called the house. Nothing. And it's like, called. And they had my radio in the from a fire department radio, and I heard him talking, all the talk on the radio and back and forth. I got more scared and more scared. And I bet you made it back here in about 10 minutes. I don't know how fast it took, but yeah, it was the fastest.
You flew back.
I flew back, and I got here. And the fire department, went, so one of the trucks was here, and I talked to a guy, and he said, yeah, it came down right in front of me. I was like, what are you talking about? The road, just the mud came out right out of the road. And so
it wasn't obvious right away where it was even coming from.
No, not coming in here blind, you know, not knowing. And so somebody said, they're bringing a kid out, you know. And I remember who it was carrying him, because it was Duke. And he was covered with mud, and he didn't look like Duke. You know, I'd known him since he was born, and didn't look like Duke at all. He said, that's not Duke, you know. We're thinking that anyways. So when the other chiefs that was showing up, he said, I tell you what, since you're so closely attached to this, you know, your family lives in this area, let's just keep you out of this for a while. So then I said, well, how about if I go over to the tracks, because there used to be a trail over there. I go up on the tracks and walk down and see how our neighborhood's doing. And so the chief says, yeah, okay, you know, take somebody with you. Let me get over there. And I walked out on the trail, and the river was down. It was all black. And it's like, it didn't register yet what's going on.
Yeah.
And now there's trees laying everywhere. So I'm like, what the hell's going on?
Everything was knocked down.
Yeah, there's trees just laying all over the place. And then I got up to where the edge of the trees where the canopy should have been, all the way back to here. And it was way down there. And this place was just covered. It's just, it was gone. I mean, it was just so obvious it was gone.
Yeah.
It's like, me personally, at that moment, I thought they'll never find us, anyone. Ever, you know, when you look at the mass of it, there was any trees here, and you just look for a mile and there's nothing, you know. Yeah.
But the community brought everybody home.
Yep.
Huge, huge accomplishment.
My wife, Chris, was first, and our neighbor, Chris Ruggelbriggy, she was the last one found. Yeah. If you sat in our kitchen window, this is what you'd see.
The mountains and the trees and just
the snow on the hilltops. And yeah, so it's a group that the families, you know, we get together and talk, and people always say, how you doing? It's, you know, you're the worst thing in your whole life that could ever happen, and people, it's just a canned response, you know. It's just, they don't know what else to say. That one is, be nice. And, well, how you doing? We were talking one day, and somebody said, you know something, I think it's nice to see you is a lot nicer way to put it. And with the grief, it's different for everybody, you know.
So they put these in to kind of mark where the houses were?
No, I did that.
You did that. You put this plate here.
Yep, when they're still filling the highway in.
Yeah.
So the action sports, that's not normally the numbers are reflective, but I want to get our steel drive on there. So I went down to local spot, Extra Sports, and I know the guy that owns it, Richard Simph. I said, hey, Richard, can you help me with this? He said, sure. So
I love the ownership you take of this. You know, it's like nobody's cutting down the weeds and the brush. You're going to come out and do it. You're going to put the sign on for your address plate. Like, it's yours, you know?
Yeah, it's still home. Like, I live down the road. I have a nice house again. We had a nice house, and we had a nice family. And now I have a nice house, but I'm missing the family. And it's, yeah, not, I don't know. It's just sad sometimes, you know?
Today we're remembering the anniversary of the Oso landslide. It was 10 years ago this week that 43 people were killed in the deadliest landslide in U.S. history, and the Oso and Darrington communities were forever changed. To learn more about the possible causes of this disaster and what's being done to prevent similar tragedies, we reached out to David Montgomery. Montgomery is a professor of geomorphology with the University of Washington, and he served on a landslide commission appointed by the governor in the wake of Oso. So I started with the basics. What caused the deadly Oso slide?
The short answer is it was really wet in the month before that. We had an ungodly amount of rainfall in that previous month. And that hill was, you know, naturally prone to instability. It had failed many times in the past, you know, some historically recently, others in the deeper geologic past. And it really failed in a way that it hadn't before in terms of how far it went. But that the Oso slide was just another slide in a series of dominoes that fell at that spot. It just behaved a little differently. So, you know, what caused the slide? A lot of rain. You know, they're potentially contributing factors. People have talked about forestry practices. The river cutting the toe of the slope out certainly didn't help over the long run. But the proximal cause was a whole mess of water.
Yeah. Those previous slides, in recorded history at least, had happened in 1951, 1967, 88, 96, and 2006. So certainly the landslide risk was known. There's been a lot of reporting on how Steelhead Haven as a neighborhood got built in the first place, which was without a floodplain permit. And yet, even after the 1967 slide, which took out a bunch of homes there, there was more building in the 1970s. So if landslides were a known risk here, why were homeowners like Seth Jeffords not warned about the hazards?
Well, you just mentioned that it was a flood zone. And, you know, floods and landslides are very different hazards. And so if you look at the pre-2014 county hazard maps, the hazard that was identified on the valley bottom was flooding. Now, that's very different than what actually happened there during the Oso landslide, right? And so if you looked at the landslide hazard maps, what you'd see is that, you know, the state had mapped landslides all up and down that valley, you know, for years. The Geologic Survey had done that, that the feds had done it. Where the landslides were very well identified in advance. But that wasn't where people built their houses. They weren't building on the landslides. And so a really critical component of translating sort of landslide hazard into landslide risk is not just where the slides actually are, but where they're going to end up. And that's what really was a big part of the problem, where if you were a homeowner looking to buy a place in Steelhead Lane sort of before the Oso landslide and you consulted hazard maps, you'd think that flooding was the hazard, when landsliding turned out to be the really big one there.
You know, over the years, families of people killed in the landslide have reached settlements with the state over a crib wall fence on state property that may have affected the path of the landslide. There was also a logging company that had recently cleared a hillside above the slide that was part of those settlements. The state restricts logging in areas that might worsen landslide risks, and they did prior to the Oso landslide, too. How does logging potentially worsen landslide risk?
The way that logging can affect landslide frequency or propensity is sort of twofold. The most obvious connection is through the strength of roots in holding soil on a hillside. And that has a huge effect post-logging on sort of what we refer to as shallow landslides, landslides that mostly just involve the soil. Now, the Oso landslide was not a shallow landslide. It was a really deep one. That probably didn't contribute much to this failure. The other way is through contributions that affect the groundwater. that is supplied to a site. Because what usually happens to trigger a landslide is one of two things. Either an earthquake shakes it loose, or it gets wet enough that it slides off the hill. So if you cut down trees in the groundwater recharge area, the area that's contributing groundwater to a slope, those trees are no longer acting as straws to suck the water up and evapotranspirate it back to the atmosphere. So you get a higher groundwater table, which translates into a higher likelihood of slope failure. Now, did that contribute to the Oso slide? Well, it certainly didn't help. That much, you know, I'm pretty confident of. But the area that was logged was not very large. You know, whether that was enough to actually contribute much to the groundwater table, you know, there was record-breaking rainfall in the month before. The logging certainly didn't help, but was it the primary cause? You know, I actually really kind of doubt that. And I have a long history of tangling with the timber industry over this issue.
One thing you mentioned that has changed since the Oso slide is the use of LIDAR technology to map most of the state of Washington. Can you explain just first what LIDAR is and how it can help us with landslide risk?
Sure. You know, from a geologist's perspective, LIDAR is a brand new pair of glasses for looking at the terrain. I mean, it's amazing. And what it is it's basically you take a laser, you put it in an airplane or a helicopter, point it straight down and fly over the terrain and measure how long it takes that light to bounce from your sender back onto the ground, back to a receiver. And what that does, it's basically you're scanning the terrain. You can make a 3D model of the terrain in really high resolution. The landslides just pop right out. You can map them if you know what you're looking for. And even if you don't know what you're looking for, you can kind of go, oh, is that a landslide? This technology really gave us a fairly straightforward way to really improve our ability to know where are the landslides that have already happened. What it doesn't necessarily do is tell you where they might happen in the future. And what it certainly doesn't do is tell you what a hill is made of. And that matters to the kind of hazard that a landslide might present, not only for the propensity of landsliding, but for the character of the landslide that may ultimately come from a slope.
So Washington has mapped most of the state, the Department of Natural Resources, and yet county by county, there's a big difference in how much that information is accessible to the public. Seattle Times reported that Snohomish County has used LIDAR to identify more than 12,000 buildings and 60,000 people that sit in landslide hazard zones right now. And according to their analysis, this is by far the most accessible presentation where somebody can just easily open up a map and see, OK, where do I live? Am I in these zones that are of concern? Now that LIDAR has been collected across the state, what's the obligation for what we do with that? Like, should more states and counties be stepping forward and really putting that out in an accessible manner for people the way Snohomish County is?
Yes, I actually think that, you know, we should probably have a state level program of actually identifying landslide hazard areas along the lines of what I believe Oregon has. For some reason, we seem to be doing it county by county, and it does vary a lot. But the other issue there is what information is actually being conveyed. The key thing that's usually left off the table is where the landslides might go, where they may run out to. And that, of course, was the big problem at Oso. The landslide hazard was correctly identified in terms of where the slide existed at the time the mapping was done, but it didn't convey any information to a potential homeowner about where those slides may actually go, particularly in a worst case kind of scenario. There's often a lot of hesitation, I think, amongst agencies in terms of putting lines on the map that suggest where a landslide might go. You can pretty much count on the fact that whatever actually happens is not going to be what you predicted might happen. You take your best shot, but each landslide tends to be unique, and it may under or over extend across a line that one puts on a map and trying to identify landslide runout zones. So it's a tricky business to try and get just right. And in a highly litigious society, I can understand why agencies might be loath to actually put those maps out. On the other hand, in a highly litigious society, the government's the only people that can do that. Because, you know, it could, if you identify landslide hazard zones, including runout, so you're not just mapping where the slides are, which you can, you know, objectively define, there's going to be controversy in terms of what it does to property values. Some people will be upset. They don't want to know that, perhaps. Other people will be upset that, you know, we haven't told people.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the home buying process, you can't even tell people what you find in a basic home inspection in this state without it opening up kind of a litigious situation. Homeowners don't want to know about anything that would lower their property values. And so we've even seen places like Juneau, Alaska, where there was this big push against updating its landslide and avalanche hazard maps because of the damage that that can do to property values. The city ended up releasing it, but saying that they didn't agree to releasing it, something like that. It was kind of an odd agreement that they came to. I mean, this is a big concern, though, I would imagine, David. I mean, have we seen this occurring in other places where it's a little bit like you want to just stick your head in the sand because you, if you are a homeowner in one of these areas, how can you then get out of your house if you are in a landslide risk area?
Yeah, I mean, there's a real sort of a tension there between the sort of the interests of an existing landowner or homeowner who may want to stick their head in the sand if they don't want to know. But you have to weigh that against the potential hazard and risk for someone who would be walking in to buy a place like that. And I don't think that government has, you know, any business really hiding the truth from people. I mean, that's sort of a core value of how I look at science and government. If there is a risk and if there is a hazard, well, that probably ought to be incorporated into property values. Now, that does mean, though, that if you're going to get into the business of trying to predict landslide runout zones, you want to do it well so that you're not either over predicting hazards or you're not under predicting. You're trying to get it right. You know, the only real entity in this society that has the ability to be indemnified against most calls like that are going to be government agencies performing a legislatively mandated public service. I would love to see much more progress in that area. But there are some very fundamental tensions involved there that, you know, transcend the realm of science and get squarely into the realm of politics. People definitely deserve to know. If there's a known hazard out there, people deserve to know about it so they can make their own decisions about things. And, you know, and that's one element of how people can actually try and protect themselves would be to try and, if you're thinking about buying a piece of property, look at the landslide hazard maps. Think about where they may go. You might want to consult with a geologist. We can make our decisions about what kind of risk to accept individually or collectively if we understand those risks. And I worry that with the landslide hazards, we're only doing a partial job in terms of identifying where the hazard may be, but not adequately conveying to the public what the actual risks might be so that people can make informed choices for themselves.
David Montgomery is a professor of geomorphology with the University of Washington, and he served on a governor-appointed landslide commission in the wake of the Oso landslide of 2014. He also has a book out. It's called What Your Food Ate, How to Heal Our Land and Reclaim Our Health. David, thank you very much for joining me and for sharing your expertise. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Happy to talk to you.
As you just heard, there are things individuals can do to try to protect themselves from landslides, but there's a lot of key data that can only practically be gathered and maintained by governmental agencies. I'm talking about things like maps of past landslides and potentially hazardous areas. Here in Washington, that kind of mapping is often done at the county level. KUOW environment reporter John Ryan covered the Oso slide 10 years ago. He investigated how policies around logging and home building near landslide zones could have contributed to the tragedy. And more recently, he's been looking into how counties have changed their landslide regulations and policies since the disaster. And he joins me now. Hi, John. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Libby. My pleasure. And, you know, before we start on the data and the regulations, I want to play you a bit of sound and see if you can guess what that is.
Okay. It sounds like pop rocks crackling. I have no idea. What is it?
You're right on the rocks, but not on the pop. I recorded that beneath a bluff on Whidbey Island, and it's a lot of small rocks tumbling and sliding down to the shoreline beneath that bluff. So sort of a very mini landslide. And to me, it's a reminder that, you know, landslides aren't exactly the enemy here. They're a natural geological process that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to stop. But, you know, crumbling bluffs in particular, they're also an important source of sand and sediment. That's what our beaches are made of. So if we don't have crumbling bluffs, we won't have beaches for long. The problems and the tragedies, they really arise when humans put themselves in harm's way, knowingly or not. And the conflicts arise over how much do we as a society try to prevent that from happening?
So you looked at landslide policy in a few different counties, John. Walk me through which ones you chose and why.
Yeah, well, I started in Snohomish County because that's where Oso is. And then I also looked into the other two biggest counties in the state. That's King and Pierce, which, you know, Seattle and Tacoma being the main cities there.
And what did landslide policy in these counties look like prior to Oso?
So all across the state, any place that's deemed a critical area is off limits to building. That's under the state's Growth Management Act. So that's places like wetlands or landslide hazards. But under that state act, it's mostly up to each city or county to decide what places should be considered a landslide hazard. And in Snohomish County, you couldn't build in those landslide zones or a buffer area right next door, sort of. That buffer is where, say, the mud or rocks might pour out to, the runout zone. And many counties in Washington allow construction in those runout zones. In Snohomish County, back then, before Oso, there was no building allowed in a runout zone about half as wide as a landslide slope was tall, if you can picture that. So if you have a 600-foot high landslide zone, there would be a buffer of 300 feet sideways down at the bottom because landslides don't necessarily stop just on the slope. They can keep running as the Oso slide did.
And what's changed in the last 10 years since this tragedy?
Well, Snohomish County has increased that buffer zone where you can't build. They did that quite quickly after the Oso slide, about a year later. And it's now twice the height of a big landslide area. But still, that wouldn't have protected the homes in Oso that were destroyed. It was such an extreme landslide that it, you know, crossed a river and ran for nearly a mile, way more than twice the height of that 600-foot high or so hillside.
You know, back in 2014, Mike Baker and Ken Armstrong at the Seattle Times reported that the Steelhead Haven neighborhood, where most of the deaths took place, was never permitted in the first place back in the 50s for development in a floodplain. And if that original developer had applied for a permit, there's a possibility she wouldn't have gotten it. Most of the original homes there were built in the 60s, wiped out in a 1967 landslide, which by some miracle didn't injure anybody. But then more homes were built there starting in the 1970s. John, could this happen today? I mean, is there a landslide risk review process before counties approve new developments?
I mean, many counties have very small buffer zones around their known landslide hazards. So if a landslide runs out beyond that buffer, homes could be hit. I spoke with Tim Trahimovich. He's a planner and advocate at a nonprofit called FutureWise. They push for tighter regulations around landslide zones.
The concern was if we adopted protective regulations, we would just limit development so much that we couldn't have enough houses or enough jobs. But, you know, they're not super widespread areas. So if we regulate them well, we'll better protect people and property, and we're not going to see a big hit on our housing capacity.
One study here in King County of the King County Lowlands found that landslide zones occupied about 4% of the total land area. Trahimovich praised Pierce County, just to King County south, for having one of the biggest buffer zones all along, about 300 feet from the base of a big landslide slope. King County right now has one of the smallest, of just 50 feet in some cases. Trahimovich says that King County is now updating its comprehensive plan and proposing to weaken some landslide provisions. To be specific, the county wants to allow its staff to reduce buffer areas without having to do a geological study. So his group opposes that. And it's just an example of the kind of this tension between letting people do what they want with their property and protecting people from harm that can befall them.
Yeah. And the need to, you know, build more homes and find places for those homes to go and the natural risks that go along with that. John, how has climate change affected the risk of landslides in Washington?
Well, we know that with the climate heating up, there's all sorts of severe consequences coming down the pike. And one of those that we expect to see is more intense storms. You know, rain is landslide fuel. That's one reason that Washington and Oregon are really some of the most landslide-prone states in the country. And climate scientists expect that as there's more energy in the atmosphere, the hydrological cycle will speed up and we'll have more intense rainstorms. And that would be more landslide fuel and could intensify landslides. Whether we're seeing that yet is somewhat debated. You know, there's no debate that the climate has already started heating up, but rainfall is a kind of a different story. It's a really noisy signal. They say that it's hard to tell whether we've seen intensified rain yet, or it's just part of the kind of that noisy signal of rain varies a lot from year to year.
And of course, intensifying wildfires, we're going to see potentially more hillsides being denuded as those forests are affected. So that all plays into these risks. John, let's talk about what's happening at a federal level. Washington Senator Maria Cantwell and Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski introduced a bill in February that would reauthorize the National Landslide Preparedness Act. It would also increase funding to $40 million per year through 2034. How might that help prevent future natural disasters in Washington?
Well, that money's going mostly to science, to research for mapping landslide zones so that builders or homeowners can know, have a better understanding, is this land I'm on risky or not? So far, the Washington Department of Natural Resources has mapped about a half dozen counties in Washington, and that leaves 30-some counties left to go. So a lot of that money will help expand where the mapping has been done. But beyond that, the federal government's role is pretty limited beyond the funding. The big decisions happen at the local level: how much risk to let builders and homeowners take on, and how much to stop them from doing so on their own property. It's basically the same tension or policy question for landslides, for wildfires, floods, all of these disruptive natural processes that we expect will get more intense as our climate keeps heating up.
That's John Ryan. He covers the environment for KUOW. John, thanks very much.
Sure thing.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.